Greetings!
Isn't that nifty?
Well, well, modern technology is service to for mankind's benefit for once.
And I'm even more amazed and intrigued that the person operating this equipment, it's working.
Well, we'll regale our public with further details of my technical prowess as this, as what we'll call the stump chronicles are recorded.
That's right, and I've got them. It's bribery.
Yes, you do have a bit of leverage, but don't exert it in the first minute. I should let my listeners know that I am, of course, speaking to the immortal Greg Stump, a filmmaker to, as he's known, to the world. But, of course, there is more to the man than that. He's more than just a good look. There's real substance here. Dare I call it chewy? It sounds a little odd. Since we're going to spend a little time together, let's peel back the veil of time to young Stumpy. You know, right now the film is switching from color to black and white as we go back in time to the idyllic sort of Opie-like youth of one Greg Stump. In light of all you've learned since about the world and how it works, would you describe your upbringing as idyllic?
Well, not idyllic. I wouldn't say idyllic because that sounds impossible. I don't know anyone who had an idyllic childhood. But there were many idyllic elements of it. I think, skiing for one thing, and the fact that skiing was a family sport, so it was something that we all did together. And, you know, my parents were so supportive of the three of us because we all, Kimberly, Jeffrey, and I, we all competed in the very early freestyle junior masters competitions. I started when I was nine, and I think Jeff was like seven when he started competing. The family and the skiing part, that was very idyllic.
What about schooling? I mean, you had something of a scholastic household.
Well, my parents, for sure. I was not a good student, especially in high school, but my father is a PhD in theater history from Indiana University, and he was there in the late 60s, and that was, it was really one of the better theater departments, except possibly Yale School of Drama, in the country. So Dad had a PhD from this great university, and then my mom had her master's, and she was a first grade teacher. So both parents were, you know, college educated and teachers. Because when you have a dad as a PhD in theater history, you know, you learn a lot of stuff that you're exposed to a lot of stuff that you, I mean, unless you took it, we were a theater major, you wouldn't be exposed to this stuff. But yeah, as kids we were. So yeah, many elements were identified.
You also went to work at a very tender age. This podcast will be experienced much like old time radio was by prior generations. Now, you cut your teeth in that medium. What was it like being at what tender age were you when you were at a megawatt station?
Well, I was 18 by the time I got to WBLM, which at the time was, I mean, we reached from the outskirts of Quebec City to the outskirts of Boston and everything in between. The transmitter was on top of this mountain, and it was this like killer station. So I was a part-timer there, and then eventually became like the utility fill-in guy when the star jocks would go on vacation. I'd fill in for 2 weeks any of the shifts. But I actually started in radio at a college station when we were in high school, because at our high school they had a program that you get out of school on Friday mornings and go work and get, you know, like take this supposed class in radio. There's only two of us, three of us wanted to do it. So we were like, what's wrong with these idiots? You get out of school? go and I know. How would they not want to do this? So there's just three of us. And what was supposed to be like this radio tutorial class thing at the local college station, we got there, this Friday morning, like, you know, 6 a.m. There's this scrawny, skinny-haired, you know, big kid, college kid, smoking a cigarette, drinking a coffee, going, here's the turntables, there's the pots, I gotta go. And he just left us there.
So unstructured.
We're like, yes, yes. And that was the big thing. And there was no class, so we just made up our own shows. And then in the summers, by the time summer rolled around, we had keys to the place.
Now that goes in the idyllic column, don't you think? I mean,
yeah, but they didn't know we did.
That's even better.
No, right? But the college is out of session, so there's nobody there to run the station. So we had 4-hour show. We run it all day long, just do hours and hours of unscripted, unsupervised, totally creative radio as, 14, 15-year-olds. So it was really, that was idyllic. And that's where I fell in love with the medium. And so getting a job at BLM, that was for me like, it's like, oh, I'm skiing snowbird now.
You had, this particular job of your youth, I think certainly segues very naturally just through different technology filters, if you will, to your best known career as a filmmaker. But before leaping forward to that, you had some other unusual employment up. If you had handed your resume into ZipRecruiter, for example, wouldn't it include a stint as Hamburglar?
Oh yeah, 4 years. Yeah, I was the Hamburglar for all of
them. coveted territory.
It was. I was one heartbeat away from the Hamburglar. I was. I'm serious, because in Chicago, and because there was the Ronald, and they were all out of this advertising agency in Chicago, where McDonald's headquarters were. But that was where the Robin, the Ronald and Hamburglar, and the Grimace, Mayor McCheese, all of them, but most notably Ronald and the Hamburglar. But I was regional, and we had a tour to show around. So yes, I did play the Hamburglar.
Wow, that must have, did it follow? Was there any follow up to that? Did you ever segue into another role of similar dimension?
I actually, when I was in California after high school, that was another crazy adventure. We were selling nautical antiques from Maine, but I was going to go apply at Disneyland for a Mickey Mouse or one of the characters, because it's really an art form. I mean, it was a blast, because you're anonymous. Like, I've got this big rubber thing on, and I'm the right size to be the Hamburglar. He was short, and a cape and the suit, and nobody knows it's you. So it's complete pantomime.
Must have appealed to the anarchist in you.
The mime, the artist, I don't know, because it was, you get to play a character, and I was really good at it, because my Hamburglar was very quick, very fast, like these parade routes, like Ronald would have to have security, because we'd have to go through these big lines of bikers at some of these parades in Maine, right? And but not me. I'd go right up to the bikers, and I'd because the Hamburglar mumbled, if you remember. But I'd whisper in the ear of the biker, go, fuck Ronald. Right? And they'd be like, yeah, Hamburglar, all right. So, meanwhile, the Hamburglar, they're all saying, fuck you, Ronald. the bikers were. And he had security, Ronald. But yeah, we had a whole traveling show. We had this big giant bus with a stage that folded down. We had a puppeteer. It was a full-on production. Like in northern Maine, where they have nothing to do, we'd have 2,000 people show up at a McDonald's show.
That's just wonderful.
And I got paid for it.
I hate to bring this up, but this is actually going to be a sort of a ski-related blog, and we're almost 10 minutes in, and we haven't even mentioned skiing very much, except...
Oh, I see. I thought you were going to tell me to stop saying fuck, because you'd have to bleep them.
Oh, well, I mean, you say it with such eloquence and such passion. Why would I want to, bleep it? I'm not here to change the news, man. Oh. Just here to report it. As far as the cinematic viewing public's concerned, hot dog skiing began with Barrymore's priceless footage of one of the first money on the table contests on Ajax Ridge of Bell. Barrymore would go on from these humble beginnings to become your mentor in the whole business of ski movie making. But long before that, we had the Ridge of Bell contest. When relative to that sort of seminal date on the timeline of freestyle, where were you throwing your first moves in the free run that you got in your youth?
Well, our ski school director was a guy named Rudy Wersch at Pleasant Mountain Bridge, Maine. He was a Swiss guy, and he had a couple other Swiss instructors that were there as well, Emil and Freddie. But they could all do Royal Christies and the javelin trick. If you remember, I could do a Royal Christie before I could do a proper parallel turn. Because we were just kids, so yeah, we want to do that. So we were, you know, and then just instantly got into ballet. So, I mean, I'm talking like 10 years old, 11. I mean, I have trophies from 71. I would have been 11 years old. Because there were, you know, those organized competitive contests for kids. The Peter Pinkham out of North Conway, New Hampshire, had this thing called, you know, Ski Masters. The Ski Masters, you know, that was the program. But then they had this thing. So you had to do your parallel and your short swing and all your final forms like a PSIA instructor would. But then you had a thing called the free run, where now we could start laying down the tricks, because we had tip rolls and, you know, 72. So that big contest at Waterville Valley had happened. So we, you know, amateur freestyle, and, you know, maybe about 4 years later, the thing had evolved into where we were going to have three different events, no final forms. So you'd have ballet, moguls, and aerials. And as amateurs, we could only do upright aerials. But yeah, it was a totally organized tour. And I mean, I know so many kids that I still know today. That's how we met, was on that junior masters early freestyle.
I should explain to our listeners.
Oh, I got tears in my eyes.
A quick snippet. Rudy Wersch is a very famous name in acrobatic skiing. And he was featured in quite a few films because he was, well, he was cinematic gold. He could juggle. He could, you know, ski on stilts. He was a comic, but he was also a phenomenal technician. And if you ever saw him ski around Aspen, I mean, he was very much an iconic figure. So to say that, you know, Rudy Wersch, it doesn't really mean much to most of our listeners today, but trust me, in the day, everybody, he was the best skier on the mountain, wherever he was.
Yeah, so he had this gig at Pleasant Mountain being this ski school director, and he brought in a couple of his Swiss buddies. But yeah, like at the Boston Ski Show, Rudy would rappel out of, like, you know, some 30th floor building, whatever the tallest building, he'd get, sneak his way out of. Like, he'd rappel down and make all the newspapers in Boston. And then he was in those early Hart films that Roger Brown made.
Oh, right. Right, with Art Fuhrer.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Herman Gollner.
Gollner was a brilliant skier.
All those guys
was breathtaking.
So, you know, without knowing it, we were being, you know, mentored by this totally famous Swiss skier. But I don't know why he ended up at Pleasant Mountain, because he was at Mount Snow before. But I know at Pleasant Mountain, he tried to screw everybody's wives.
Well, he's a ski instructor at the time. That was sort of written into the resume. The head of the ski school where I grew up at Bromley Mountain, Neil Robinson, ended up running off with Fred Pabst Jr.'s wife, which is sort of the running off with the owner's wife is sort of the acme, ski instructor dumb. He also appeared in a Brill Cream ad, which at the time was pretty, you know, big stuff.
Oh, yeah. A little dabble, do you?
Sure. At any rate, but back to us. So your humble roots then in Maine, you end up, however many years later, you pass through the great arc of your cinematic career, which, trust me, listeners, we will not just blush over in the future, but right now we will. And you end up in Whistler. You're already famous pretty much throughout the ski world. You're still in the absolute bloom of youth and dating, if not the hottest woman in town, certainly a contender as a go-go dancer. And it's just, you know, holy moly. And in a town of, you know, that wasn't underpopulated with good-looking women. So tell us about your life during this sort of heyday, which you must admit, it must have exceeded your dreams, didn't it?
How do you mean my dreams? Like what I
thought? Yeah, I mean, here you are. I mean, you.
No, I had absolutely nothing surprised me at all about what was happening, because I knew it would. I mean, when I, after we shot Blizzard of Oz, I mean, I sat down with my best friend, who you actually have played tennis with. That's a whole other story, yes. Dear listeners, that we're going to get to. But I sat down with my friend Dave, and I mapped out an entire outline of how Blizzard of Oz should be put together if something happened to me, because I was so confident this was going to be a big hit. So no, nothing surprised me. Plus, you know, I came out of, you know, Rudy Wersch world and, you know, Dick Barrymore world. And, you know, then on my dad's side, I mean, my father knew Sir Laurence Olivier, and it's, you know, and my parents were from California, so dad knew all. It just making it big didn't seem. It was that's what I was doing.
So the moment, but the moment was never too big.
I think things eventually got too big. Like Whistler, I blew up out of there when I was over it, and same thing with working in Hollywood doing commercials. I mean, I directed a Super Bowl commercial for Disney starring Tony Hawk, but I wouldn't want to do that any longer, because I didn't really.
Right, and you've also worked with Seal and Willie, just to tantalize our listeners that we'll be talking about all sorts of other aspects of Stump's career that you probably had knew nothing about. But I'll stop fantasizing about your life in Whistler, promise, and I'll move on.
Well, no, it was good. Don't get me wrong. I mean, it was a great time to be there, because there was nobody there yet.
Yeah, it had to be ski bum. Something close to it.
You know what? Because people would always say, "Oh, you're so great making ski movies. You get to ski all the time." And I'm like, "I'm on skis, but I'm not skiing. I'm carrying a 75-pound pack. So I didn't get to ski at all those great places that I was filming. Whereas at Whistler, I stopped making the yearly ski movie and said, screw it. I mean, I'll go to LA and make 10 grand a day doing commercials and come back and hang out for the however long and ski. Because I was walking distance from the Creekside chair in the creek on Whistler, old Whistler, that side. And, you know, like when they put the quad in down there, and there was still no condos or people or nothing. It was a dirt mud parking lot, but there was this high speed quad now. So, you know, it's 4,000 vertical from that parking lot up to the peak on Whistler. And, you know, you hit a powder day where if it's powder down in that valley, I mean, it's going to be deep and fluffy up in the top 2,000 vertical. So I finally got to ski a ton at Whistler. And then, you know, with Ace being, you know, the head go-go dancer, and then she started recruiting other girls. So she was like go-go mama. So it wasn't just Ace. It was a whole bevy.
This would be fair to describe as the idyllic part of Europe.
Well, yeah. I mean, the first 7 years were absolutely idyllic. No, it was a blast. And, you know, it was unreal. Like, they gave me, you know, two free dual mountain passes for a decade. So, you know, Ace and I got to ski for free. That was A, you know, and then we lived there.
Just so people appreciate the context a little further, Canadians didn't necessarily invent partying, but they sure as hell have perfected it.
Well, they poured a little gasoline on the fire. Oh yeah, no, I had no idea. I mean, there's people in Whistler that knew me then when I first moved that will tell you I was a goody two shoes at that time. And hang on 1 second, Jack. I'm doing a phone interview.
Okay. Actually, Stumpy.
Really? Is there a number I can call you? Because I've been wanting.
That's okay. We can take a break here because we just hit 20 minutes. So we'll figure out a way to edit that down. But I think we could say adieu for the moment.
Yeah, let me run because I got a slight emergency in my hand.
Talk to you later. Bye.
Sorry, I'm just doing an interview. He's in the hospital.